Chapter 19. The librarian crisis. Like a guilty secret, it lurked behind the veneer of unity, a dull ache that the body of the Imperium had tried to forget, like a frightened man ignoring a pain in his belly for fear of what might come to light under the glare of examination. Librarians had first been introduced to the legions when Magnus, Sanguinius, and Jagatai Khan had promised a regime of psychic training and development that went hand in hand with the already rigorous creation process of an Astartes warrior. The Emperor had sanctioned these first experiments as a means of directing and controlling the power of emerging psychers within the Astartes, and librarius departments were formed within the Thousand Suns, Blood Angels, and White Scars to train them. The librarians they had crafted had proven to be loyal warriors and potent weapons in the Legion's arsenal. Such was the success of these early experiments that Magnus pushed for his program to be expanded, allowing other legions to benefit from his research. With the success of the early experiments, many Primarchs came to see the usefulness of librarians and allowed warrior scholars from the Thousand Suns to form librarius departments within their ranks. Not all the Primarchs saw this as a good thing, and from the earliest days of its inception, the librarian program was beset by controversy. Psychic powers came with dark heritage, for the Great Crusade was rebuilding the lost temple of humanity from the wreckage left after Old Night, a cataclysm brought about, it was claimed, by the uncontrolled emergence of psychers all across the galaxy. As much as Magnus and his compatriots vouchsafed the integrity of the librarians, they would always bear the stigma of those who had brought humanity to the edge of extinction. Though there had been squabbles and division over the employment of librarians, those divisions had been manageable and without real weight. The Thousand Suns heard the accusations levelled at them and stoically ignored them, content that they acted with the Emperor's blessing. Like an untreated wound, those divisions had festered and spread, threatening to become a rift that would never be sealed. And so, with Horus Lupercal anointed the War Master and his retreat to Terra imminent, the Emperor chose this moment to heal that rift and bring his sons together as one. History would recall this assembly as the Council of Nicaea. Others would know it as the Trial of Magnus the Red. Othir Weirdmake crossed the amphitheatre and stepped into the plinth before the Emperor's dais. Ahriman willed Weirdmake to see him, to feel the full weight of his treachery. "I trusted him," said Ahriman, bunching his fists. "He was just using me to betray us. All along it was a lie." His anger fled as another thought intruded. "Oh, Throne!" he exclaimed. "The things I told him, our ways and our powers, this is all my fault." "Calm yourself, Azik," cautioned Magnus. "Do nothing to prove him right. In any case, it was I who urged you to place your trust in Weirdmake. If this travesty of a conclave is anyone's fault, it is mine for not giving credence to the strength of my doubters." Ahriman forced himself back into the higher spheres, focusing on those that had enhanced clarity and speed of thought. He kept away from those of empathy and strength. Weirdmake lifted his wolf-helmed head to face the glares of the Thousand Suns, his lined face pulled into a scowl of primal loathing. Such was its venom, Ahriman wondered how he could not have seen so brutal and violent a core to the Rune Priest. He had always known the Space Wolves were a butcher's blade of a legion, powerful and unsubtle, but to see that so clearly defined on one man's face was still a shock. "I will not waste time with fancy words," said Weirdmake. "I am called Othir Weirdmake of the Space Wolves, and I fought in the Murder Make with the Thousand Suns on Shrike. I stood alongside its warriors on the big salt flats of Ogoru, and I named them a coven of warlocks, every one of them a star-cunning sorcerer and conjurer of unclean magic. That is all I have to say, and I swear its truth upon my oath as a warrior of Leman Russ." Ahriman was astonished at the archaic wording of the accusation. Was this the forgotten ages, when men were ruled by superstition and fear of the dark? He cast round the amphitheatre, horrified at the sagely nodding heads and expressions of outrage directed their way. Malkador stood at the edge of the dais and wrapped his staff on its marble floor. All eyes turned upon him. "You level a terrible accusation upon your brother Legion, Othair Weirdmake," said Malkador. "Are there any who substantiate your claims?" "Aye, Sigilite, there are," replied Weirdmake. "Who stands with this accusation?" called Malkador.
"I do," said Mortarion, emerging from beneath a falsehood and revealing his identity to the onlookers.
As Othair Weirdmake returned to his seat, Mortarion walked to the centre of the amphitheatre. Whether by coincidence or design, the Death Lord took exactly 28 paces from the podium, and Adaman again saw the recurrence of the number 7. Mortarion was clad exactly as he had been on Ulanor, as though he had been waiting for this moment since then. Before Mortarion could speak, Magnus rose to his feet and slammed his hand down on the obsidian coping before him.
"Is this what passes for due process?" demanded Magnus. "Am I to be tried by faceless observers who hide behind their falsehoods? If any man dares accuse me, let him speak to my face."
Malkador wrapped his staff once more and said, "The Emperor has commanded it, Magnus. No man's testimony is to be corrupted by fear of whose eyes are upon him."
"It is all too easy to hide behind cloaks of anonymity and cast your venom. Far harder to look the object of your wrath in the eye while you do it."
"You will have your chance to speak, Magnus. No decision will be made until all those who wish to speak have done so, I promise you," said Malkador, adding, "Your father promises you." Magnus shook his head as he returned to his seat, his anger still simmering. Mortarion had not moved during Magnus's outburst, as though his brother Primarch's outrage was an inconsequential thing, something to be endured for the brief annoyance it caused. Adaman dearly wished he could summon Apio, but sensed the ensuing conflagration would be akin to letting a Pyrrhae zealoter loose in a Promethean-soaked warehouse. Mortarion bowed curtly to the Emperor and began his oration.
"Brother Malkador claims that his issue has vexed the Imperium," said Mortarion, his rustle's soft tones like the dry hiss of wind over eons old sand dunes. "But he is wrong to believe there is anything complex about the issue. I have seen the devastation that unchecked sorcery leaves in its wake. Worlds burned to cinders, populations enslaved, and monsters unleashed. Sorcery brought these worlds to ruin. Sorcery wielded by men who peered too deeply into dark places they should have known to leave well alone. We all know of the horror of old night, but I ask you this simple question. What brought about that galactic holocaust? Psychers, uncontrolled psychers, the threat of these people is horribly real, and you all know the danger they represent. Some of you may even have seen it firsthand. The Psi engines, an oculum of terror, search out the latent witch genes among humanity, and the black ships of the Silent Sisterhood trawl the stars for these dangerous individuals. Did the Emperor, beloved by all, build these machines for no reason? No, they were built to protect us from these dangerous mutants, using their powers in service of their selfish ends. That is the difference, where an astral telepath or navigator uses his powers for the good of others, allowing distant worlds to communicate, or guiding the expeditionary fleets of the Imperium across the stars. The sorcerer uses his power for personal gain, for earthly power and dominance. Yes, the Imperium needs certain empowered individuals, but only those sanctioned and rigidly controlled. We know where power unchecked inevitably leads. You have all heard the stories of old night, but who among you has really seen what that means?"
Mortarion swung his man-reaper, the deathly haft finally coming to rest upon his shoulder.
"The Death Guard have seen," said Mortarion,
and Araman wanted to laugh at his absurd theatrics. Though Mortarion played the role of the outraged righteous man, he was relishing his part in what he saw as the downfall of the Thousand Suns.
"On Kaja, my legion encountered a warrior race of humans that had fallen to barbarism. Extensive orbital surveys detected no trace of advanced technology, yet it took my legion nearly 6 months to bring Kaja to submission. Why? They were savages armed with little more than blades and crude flintlock carbines. How could such a feral race of savages hold the Death Guard at bay for so long?
Morterin paced as he spoke, the haft of the man-reaper marking time to his steps with a solid tunk every step he took.
They held us at bay because they had fell powers and unseen allies. Every night creatures of witchery hunted in the shadows and killed for the joy of killing. Blood-red hounds stalked the darkness of the forest with savage instinct, and juggernauts of thunder broke our lines with every charge.
The Death Lord paused a moment to let that last fact sink in, that anything could sunder a Death Guard formation was nothing short of a miracle. Though his desert wheeze was faint, no word of his narration escaped the attention of those gathered in the amphitheatre.
My warriors have fought Xenos species of every stripe and defeated them, but these were not creatures of flesh and blood. These were summoned into life by Kajori warlocks. These magi conjured lightning from their flesh, set fires with their thoughts, and cracked the very earth with their shouted oaths. No power comes without a price, and with every victory we won, we discovered what that truly meant. At the heart of every city we captured, my warriors found vast structures we came to know as blood fanes. Each one was a charnel house of bones and death. We destroyed every one, and with each one lost, the strength of our foes waned. In the end, we ground down every ragamuffin force they sent against us. Surrender was not in their blood, and they died to a man, destroyed by a ruling caste of warlocks who could not bear to relinquish their power. I still think of Kaja and shudder.
Morterin finished his tale in front of the Thousand Sons, the last syllable leaving his lips as he looked up at Magnus.
Now I do not accuse my brother of such barbarism, but no evil begins with such monstrous acts. If it did, no sane man would ever consider it. No, it begins slowly, a small step here, a small step there. By such acts is a man's heart turned black and rotten. A man may begin with noble intentions, believing that such small trespasses are minor things compared to the good he will do at the end of his course. But every act matters, from the smallest to the greatest. Tales of the Thousand Sons' victories are legion, but so too are the whispers of their sorceries. In the past I have led my warriors into battle alongside those of Magnus, and am well aware of what his legion can do, so I can vouch for the truth of what Othar Weirdmake says. It is sorcery. I have seen it with my own eyes, like the magi of Kajor. The cult warriors of Magnus conjure lightning and fire to smite their foes, while their brethren crush their enemies with invisible force. I do not lie when I say that I knew fear that day, the fear that I had broken one army of warlocks, only to find myself with another at my side. You all know I distrust the institution of librarians within the ranks of the Astartes, fearing for what the Thousand Sons are trying to seed within our legions. No librarians sully the ranks of the Death Guard, and nor will they while I draw breath. I have held my tongue until now, confident that others wiser than I knew best, but I can keep silent no longer. When Brother Russ and Brother Lorgar spoke of the battles fought to subdue the Arkreach cluster, I found myself compelled to break my bonds of silence, though it tears my heart to name my own brother a warlock. I cannot stand by and watch his obsessions drive him and his legion into the abyss of damnation. Know that I speak not out of hatred, but out of the love I have for Magnus. This is all I have to say.
Morterion turned and bowed once more to the Emperor before returning to the box he shared with other warriors of his legion. Adamant turned to Magnus as he heard the high, sharp crack of glass. The heat of Magnus's anger was radiating from his body. The Primarch's fists were balled on the obsidian coping. And Adamant saw the volcanic stone had softened and run like the wax of an invocation candle. Blobs of what had once been glassy rock dropped to the floor, where they shattered as their customary atomic structure reasserted its reality. "My lord," hissed Adamon, all thought of enumerations forgotten as a hot rush of imparted fury passed between them with a flash of psychic osmosis. He reached out to Magnus, his fingertips lightly brushing his Primarch's arm. Magnus felt his touch and turned his gaze upon him. Ahriman recoiled from the depthless pit of his eye, the entire structure of it a wheeling lattice of unknown colours, as though every facet of emotion fought for dominance. Ahriman's heart lurched at the anger and need for vindication he saw there, a furious battle between raging instinct and higher intellect. He saw Magnus's desire to lash out at his attackers, the animal heart that cursed his brother for his limited understanding. Holding that back was the towering intellect that held court over his base emotions, a mind that had looked deep into the warp and seen it looking back at him. In that moment of connection, Ahriman looked into the core of his Primarch's incandescent form, the incredible fusion of genius and chained ether bound in the creation of his incredible mind and body. To see the white-hot furnace of so mighty a being's innermost construction was to stare into the heart of a newly birthed star. Ahriman cried out as he saw Magnus's life unfold in the space of what could have been an instant or could have been a span of eons. He saw discourses between luminous minds in a cavern far beneath the earth, and a wondrous figure descending to Prospero atop a golden mountain range. All this and more poured into Ahriman without heed that his mind was vastly incapable of absorbing such enormous quantities of memory and knowledge. He comprehended only a fraction of what he saw, but it was enough to press him back into his seat. Breath laboured in his chest, and the awful rush of information pouring into him threatened to unseat his reason. "Stop," begged Ahriman, as more knowledge that had been won by entire civilizations thundered into his mind, squeezing his gen-hanced faculties to the limits of their endurance. His vision greyed, and blood vessels hemorrhaged in his eyes. His hands trembled, and he felt the onset of a violent grand mal seizure, one that would almost certainly kill him. Magnus closed his eye, and the raging torrent ceased. Ahriman gasped as the flood abated, and a drawn-out moan escaped his lips. Dread knowledge and buried secrets surged within him, each one a lethally volatile revelation. He fell from the bench as his overloaded consciousness shut down in an attempt to rebuild the shattered architecture of his mind. When he opened his eyes, he was lying on one of the padded couches in the vaulted antechamber beneath the amphitheatre. The pain had diminished, but his head felt as though it was encased in an ever-shrinking helmet of invisible steel. Light made his head hurt, and he raised a hand to shield his face. His mouth was dry, and a bewildering series of images danced on the periphery of his vision, like a million memories crowding for attention. "Enter the sixth enumeration," said a mellifluous voice that calmed and soothed him. "It will help you restore your thoughts." "What happened?" he managed, trying to focus on the owner of the voice. He knew he recognised the speaker, but so many names and faces crowded his mind that he could not sort through them. "I don't remember." "It's my fault, my son," said the voice, and Ahriman was finally able to perceive the figure kneeling beside him. "And I am truly sorry." "My Lord Magnus?" he asked. "In the flesh, my son," said Magnus, helping him sit up. Bright lights pounded behind his eyes, and he groaned, feeling like his brain was trying to press its way out of his skull. The Sekhmet were assembled in the chamber, some drinking from silver goblets, others guarding the doors. "You had quite a shock to the system," said Magnus. "I allowed my anger to get the better of me and let the walls enclosing my essence fall. No one mortal, not even an Astartes, should drink from that well. You'll have a monstrously sore head, but you will live." "I do not understand," said Ahriman, pressing his palms to his temples. "Knowledge is like strong liquor, my son," said Magnus with a smile. "To imbibe too much too fast will get you drunk." "I have never been drunk. I don't think it's possible for me." "It's not. Not really," said Magnus, handing him a goblet of cool water. "At least not on alcohol. How much do you remember about what happened?" "Not much," admitted Ahriman, draining the goblet in a single swallow. "That's probably for the best," said Magnus, and Ahriman was not so far removed from his senses that he didn't catch the relief in his Primarch's voice. "I remember the Death Lord," said Ahriman, "chastising us and twisting facts to suit his accusations, but after that, nothing." A sudden thought occurred, and he asked, "How long have I been unconscious?"
"Just over 3 hours, which was probably a blessing."
"How so?"
You were spared the tedious parade of close-minded bigots, superstitious fools, and throwbacks naming us heretics, sorcerers, blood mages, and sacrificers of virgins. Weird Make and Mortarian have assembled quite a coven of witch-hunters to condemn us. Ahriman rose to his feet, his legs unsteady beneath him as the room spun around him. His enhanced physiology fought to compensate, but it was a losing battle. He would have fallen but for Magnus's steadying hand. He forced the dizziness down and took a cleansing breath. Ahriman shook his head. "I feel like I have been stepped on by Canis Vertex."
"You would," said Magnus, "but you'll want to recover your wits quickly, my son."
"Why? What is happening?"
"Our accusers have said their piece," said Magnus with relish. "And now it's my turn."
Expectant silence filled the amphitheatre as Magnus strode towards the plinth. He walked with his head held high and his feathered cloak trailing behind him, looking straight at the Emperor's dais. This was no walk of the accused, but the stride of the righteous man fighting against unjust accusers. Ahriman had never been prouder to be one of his thousand sons. Magnus bowed to the Emperor and Malkador, then turned to give Fulgrim and Sanguinius bows of comradeship. In a move that spoke of grace in the face of adversity, he also gave Mortarian and Othair Weirdmake courteous acknowledgements. Magnus was every inch the gentleman polymath who never forgot himself, even as his enemies united against him. He mounted the plinth and rested his hands on the wooden lectern. He paused, sweeping his gaze around the assembled men and women, favouring them all with his attention.
"The fearful and unbelieving, the abominable and the murderers, the whoremongers and sorcerers, idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone," said Magnus, as though reading from a text. "Those words are from a book written thousands of years ago in the Forgotten Ages, ironically from a passage named Revelations. This is what people thought in those barbaric times. It shows what savagery we came from and how easily it is for our species to turn upon one another. These words of fear sent thousands to their death over the millennia. And for what? To salve the fears of ignorant men who had not the wit to embrace the power of new ideas."
Magnus stepped from the plinth, circling the amphitheatre like a lecturing iterator. Where Mortarian had hectored the assembly with venom, Magnus spoke as though every member of the assembly, from the lowliest adept to the Emperor himself, were old friends gathered for a good-natured debate.
"If one of us were to walk among the people of those times, they would kill us for the technology we possess, thinking it witchcraft or unclean devilment. For example, before the writings of Aristarchus of Samos, men believed that old Earth was flat, an unbroken plain where the oceans simply fell from the edges. Can you imagine anything more ridiculous? Now we take the sphericity of planets for granted. Much later, priestly scholars taught that Terra was the centre of the cosmos, and that the sun and planets revolved around it. The man who challenged this geocentric foolishness was tried for heresy and forced to recant his beliefs. Now we know our place in the galaxy."
Magnus paused before Mortarian, meeting the hostile glare of the Death Lord with one of quiet amusement.
"From the deepest desire often comes the deadliest hatred," he said. "And false words are not only evil in themselves, but they infect the hearts of all who hear them with evil. Imagine what we will know in 1,000 years and think, really think, what we are doing here."
Magnus turned from Mortarian and walked to the centre of the amphitheatre, lifting his hands out to his sides and slowly turning on the spot as he spoke.
"Imagine the Imperium of the future, a golden utopia of enlightenment and progress, where the scientist and the philosopher are equal partners with the warrior in crafting a bounteous future. Now, imagine the people of that glorious age looking back through the mists of time to this moment. Think what they will know and what they would make of this travesty. They would weep to know how close the flame of enlightenment had come to being snuffed out. The art and science of questioning everything is the source of all knowledge, and to abandon that will doom us to slow decay, an imperium of darkness and ignorance, where those who dare to pursue knowledge, whatever the cost to themselves, are regarded with suspicion. That is not the imperium I believe in. That is not the imperium I wish to be part of. Knowledge is the food of the soul, and no knowledge can be thought of as wrong, so long as each seeker after truth is master of what he learns. Nothing worth knowing can be taught. It must be learned with the blood and sweat of experience, and there are no greater scholars of that ilk than the Thousand Sons. Even as we fight in the forefront of the Emperor's crusade, we study the things others ignore, questing for knowledge in the places others fear to tread. There are no truths unknown, no secrets too hidden, and no paths too labyrinthine for us to follow, for they lead us upwards to enlightenment. Hard-won knowledge is of no value unless it is put into practice. Knowing is not enough. We must apply. Willing is not enough. We must do. Magnus smiled, and Adamant saw he had won over great swathes watching him. With that in mind, I beg your indulgence a little longer, said Magnus, and a tale I will thee tell. There is an ancient legend of old earth that speaks of three men of Aegina who lived in a cave deep in the mountains, said Magnus, with the warmth of a natural storyteller. Though he had heard this story before, Adamant found himself captivated by Magnus's voice, the natural charisma that loaded every commanding word. These men lived shut off from the light of the world, and they would have lived in permanent darkness but for a small fire that burned in a circle of stones at the heart of the cave. They ate lichen that grew on the walls and drank cold water from an underground stream. They lived, but what they had was not living. Day after day they sat around the fire, staring into the flickering embers and dancing flames, believing that its light was all the light in the world. The shadows made shapes and patterns on the walls, and this delighted them greatly. In their own way, they were happy, moving from day to day without ever wondering what lay beyond their flickering circle of light. Magnus paused in his recital, allowing the audience to imagine the scene and to picture the dancing shadows on the cave walls. But one day a mighty storm blew over the mountains, but so deep were the men that only the merest breath of it reached their cave. The fire danced in the wind, and the men laughed to see new patterns on the wall. The wind died, and they went back to contemplating the fire, much as they had always done. But one of the men got up and walked away from the fire, which surprised the other men greatly, and they bade him return to sit with them. This lone man shook his head, for he alone had a thirst to learn more of the wind. He followed it as it retreated from the cave, climbing steep cliffs, crossing chasms, and negotiating many perils before he finally saw a faint haze of light ahead of him. He climbed out of the cave, emerging onto the side of the mountain, and looked up at the blazing sun. Its light blinded him, and he fell to his knees, overcome by its beauty and warmth. He feared he had burnt out his eyes, but in a little while his vision returned, and he hesitantly looked around him. He had come out of the cave high on the mountain's flank, and the world was spread out before him in all its glory, glittering green seas and endless fields of golden corn. He wept to see such things, distraught that he had wasted so many years in darkness, oblivious to the glory of the world around him, a world that had been there all along, but which his limited vision had denied him. The Primarch stopped, looking up at the stars, and his rapt audience followed his gaze, as though picturing the blazing sun of his story. "Can you imagine what it felt like?" asked Magnus, his voice racked with emotion, "to have spent your entire life staring at a small fire and thinking it was the only light in the world, only to be then confronted by the sun?" The man knew he had to tell his friends of this miraculous discovery, and he made the journey back to the cave where the other men sat, still staring into the fire and smiling vacuously at the shadows on the wall. The man who had seen the sun looked at the place he had called home and saw it for the prison it truly was. He told the others what he had seen, but they were not interested in far-fetched tales of a burning eye in the sky All they wanted to do was live their lives as they had always lived them. They called him mad and laughed at him, continuing to stare at the fire as it was the only reality they knew. Adaman had first heard this story as a philosophus in the Corviday Temple, when Magnus had mentored him prior to facing the Dominus Liminus. He heard the same note of bitterness in the Primarch's voice that he had heard then, a precisely modulated pitch that conveyed the proper measure of anguish and frustration at the blindness of the men in the cave. How, Magnus's tone said, could anyone turn away from such light once they knew of its existence? The man could not understand his friend's reluctance to travel to the world above, continued Magnus, but he resolved that he would not take their refusal to come with him as an end to the matter. He would show them the light, no matter what, and if they would not come to the light, then he would bring it to them. So the man climbed back to the world of light and began to dig. He dug until he had widened the cave mouth. He dug for 100 years and then 100 more, until he had dug away the top of the mountain. Then he dug downwards, a great pit in the heart of the mountain, until he broke through into the cave where his fellows sat around the fire. Magnus fell silent, his words trailing off, though Adaman knew it was a theatrical pause rather than any real moment of introspection. Knowing how the story ended, Adaman was not surprised Magnus had stopped here. In the original version of the tale, the man's friends were so terrified by what they were shown that they killed the man and retreated deeper into the cave with their fire to live their lives in perpetual twilight. The tale was an allegorical parable on the futility of sharing fundamental truths with those with too narrow perceptions of reality. By telling it selectively, Magnus had broken his covenant with the audience, but none of them would ever know. Instead, he continued his tale with fresh words woven from his imagination. The men were amazed at what he showed them. The light they had been missing for all their lives and the golden joy that could be theirs, were they just brave enough to take his hand and follow him? One by one, they climbed from their dark cave and saw the truth of the world around them, all its wonders and all its beauty. They looked back at the dank, lightless cave they had called home and were horrified by how limited their understanding of the world had been. They heaped praise upon the man who had shown them the way to the light and honoured him greatly, for the world and all its bounty was theirs to explore for evermore. Magnus let his new ending wash over the amphitheatre, and no member of the Theatrica Imperialis had given so commanding a performance. A rolling wave of applause erupted from the tiers, and Magnus smiled. The perfect blend of modesty and gratitude. Sanguinius and Fulgrim were on their feet, though Mortarion and the Death Guard remained as stoic as ever. As pitch-perfect as Magnus's delivery had been, Ahriman saw that not all of the audience were won over. Though it was clear the case against Magnus and the Thousand Sons was no longer as cut and dried as his accusers had hoped. Magnus raised his hands to quell the applause, as though abashed to be so acclaimed. "The man knew he had to show his friends the truth of the world around them," he said, "and just as it was his duty to save his friends from their dull, sightless existence, it is our duty to do the same for humanity. The Thousand Sons, alone of all the legions, have seen the light beyond the gates of the Empyrean. That light will free us from the shackles of our mundane perceptions of reality and allow the human race to stand as masters of the galaxy. Just as the men around the fire needed to be shown the glorious future that lay within their grasp, so too does humanity. The knowledge the Thousand Suns are gathering will allow everyone to know what we know, to see as we see. Humanity needs to be led upwards with small steps, with their eyes gradually opened, lest the light blind them. That is the ultimate goal of the Thousand Suns. Our future as a race is at stake. My friends, I urge you not to throw away this chance for enlightenment, for we are at a tipping point in the history of the Imperium. Think of the future and how this moment will be judged in the millennia to come. Magnus bowed to the cardinal points of the amphitheatre. "Thank you for your attention," he said. "That is all I have to say."